Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Welcome back to Making the Case. Joel Castone is the first incarcerated person to hold public office in Washington, D.C., and he was kind enough to grant me an exclusive TV interview from the D.C. jail where he's currently being held. Joel, who was elected as an advisory neighborhood commissioner, has spent almost 3 decades in prison. He was convicted of murder at the age of 18, and the story of his life over the last 27 years behind bars is nothing short of remarkable. Tonight, we're airing my full interview with the man himself, Commissioner Castone. Now, you may be wondering how a person behind bars could be elected to public office. Well, it turns out in D.C., there isn't a specific ban or prohibition, but the mechanics of an incarcerated person getting elected are more complicated. The district where the D.C. jail is located hasn't had a representative since 2013 when it was first created. And that's because the district was made up of a jail and a women's homeless shelter. Incarcerated people couldn't vote, and shelter residents were by definition transient. All that changed last July was when D.C. joined states like Maine and Vermont in passing a bill allowing incarcerated people and people with felony convictions to vote. Suddenly, there were constituents in the district who could elect a representative, and that's how Joel's journey to public office started. An interesting footnote, there's now a luxury apartment building located in Joel's district. So not only will he be representing those who are incarcerated within the jail and those staying at the shelter, he'll also be representing those residents living in that new high-rise. When I met Joel, I wanted to understand his journey, starting with where he came from. Who was that young 18-year-old who was convicted of murder? What was he like to the 44-year-old who just made history and now holds an elected office?
I would say, humble, there's no way I can be in this position. I had to give a strong shout out to all the returning citizens who have pounded pavement. These individuals have made our voices heard. They're doing remarkable jobs in the society, which convinced the council members here, D.C. council members, to pass this progressive law that allowed incarcerated residents to be able to vote in the first place and to run for public office. So I feel humble. I feel humble, and I would say this. I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
Look at you, talking like a politician already. All right, so before we get into your remarkable campaign and your future, I'd like to briefly talk about your past. You've been incarcerated for 26 years since you were 18. Why were you incarcerated?
I was incarcerated for a murder, a case that happened when I was 18 years of age. And since that time of my incarceration, as you had just already referenced, for 27 calendar years now, I turned 45 on the 13th of July this month here. And so from 18 to 45, which is a large span of time, it's just, I would say, just coming outside of that dark space, if you will. There's no way you can survive the amount of time I've been incarcerated if you don't rely on God. So I'm the first to admit that my faith is what anchored me. And so my queen, which I call my mom, she was the person who told me to turn to God. And I turned to God, and God began to revive my spirit. And so now, not only am I using the term returning citizen, as my pastor teaching me, I'm a redemptive citizen.
So tell me, who was Joel Castone at 18 years old? What was he like?
He was no different from most of the young guys that come from inner city communities, unfortunately. We understand that the root of mass incarceration is poverty, joblessness, poor education, all these things which created the monster we call mass incarceration, but also predates that when we go back to slavery, convict leasing, and Jim Crowism, and redlining, all these things, all these dynamics, and we don't really want to throw into the mix the war on drugs and what the crack epidemic did into our community. So growing up as a young man inside of Washington, D.C., which is the political capital of the world, I was always aware of politics, right? Even when I was a kid, I talk about this in my memoir. I ran for public to be a student council member. That is, to be a student councilman when I was a kid, and so just wanted to be involved. And so that young person who I was, I like to say I was a clueless teen. Now I'm a commissioner, right? And so just coming from being a clueless teen who did not know his full.
Mr. Commissioner, if you don't mind me calling you Joel, right?
Yeah.
You earned that title, but I definitely want this to be more of an informal interview. I'm going to call you Joel. So you are now 44, about to be 45. If you had the opportunity to talk to your 18-year-old self, if you could give yourself at 18 any piece of advice, what would that be?
Don't be afraid to strive. Don't be afraid to be the best version that you can possibly be. Oftentimes, I think that in my personal story, as well as many members that come from my community, our narrative was shaped by our surroundings. And so I remember one time my family asked me, I actually went to a school that's outside of my district, and that school was the first time I was experiencing something that was other than what I formerly knew. That's just say drugs and violence and things of that nature. And I ran away from there. I ran away from it. I didn't even want to be a part of it because I felt like it was not me. Now, here I am, and all I want to be is in that type of stuff, right? And so not only do I want to be in that type of stuff, I want to go back to the young people that come from where I come from and let them say that you may have started here. You may have begun. You may have begun here, but you don't have to end it.
Now, before we get into your actual campaign run, tell me about some of the things that you've done while you've been incarcerated.
Yeah, since I've been incarcerated, I can say that outside of I actually had a spiritual awakening, the next thing I did was I began to pursue higher education, encouraged by an older gentleman who was my mentor, who encouraged me to get my GED. And once I got my GED, the light bulb went off. It was like, oh, my goodness. First, I didn't think I was going to get it. Then once I got it, I'm like this, wow, such a new world of possibilities opened up. And so the first thing I wanted to do was that my God brother, he encouraged me, he said, hey, if you want to take college classes, I'll pay for it. And so I began to look into what I want to do as far as college classes, and that led me down the track of finance. And I got into finance, but I didn't know finance is such a broad field. Business is a broad field. In fact, I just looked at business first. Then I went from business to finance. And once I got into finance, because I had a small nest egg saved up, and a lot of banks were asking my mom about, what do you want to do with this money here? My mom, hey, you got this money, what you want to do with it? I said, Mom, give me a second, right? Let me figure this out. And the stock market was booming at that time. And I got into the stock market. I remember Tavis Smiley. He was had a little show on BET and demystifying the stock market. I used to watch the PBS station. They talk about the Wall Street Week with the late Louis Lutyens. And I got into that, and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the numbers. I fell in love with the fact that there were not enough people of color on that show. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that inspired me. I said, you know what? I want to learn this. And I started reading every, I started devouring every book that centered around finance. And I can say that I had a little money. I didn't have a lot, but I had a little money. And so I was trying to encourage my child's mom at the time to do some investing for me. And she said, you sound like you're talking Chinese. And so I had to break it down for her, right?
Yeah.
And in the process of me breaking it down, I started writing. And I shared my writings with my peers. My peers were like, who wrote that? And I wrote that. Like, you wrote that? Man. And that's when I realized I had a solid grasp on understanding the markets. And that's what took me to where I'm at now, because I just became a financial geek. And I like saying that because I'm a geek. That's basically it. I'm a financial geek. I'm a self-published author. I wrote my book, Currency Catchers, that's available on Amazon. And I walk my readers in how to understand the markets, the beginner's version. And I want to eliminate intergenerational poverty caused by the absence of asset ownership for people in disinvested communities.
Listen, you are light years ahead, because, I mean, that's what we're just now getting into, and financial literacy for our community is so important. All right, so to your campaign. You know, as a criminal defense attorney, I've represented people behind bars, and it isn't the kind of environment where hope lives, right? Instead, for the most part, it's where hope dies. Tell me what motivated you to run.
That's a power. The way you framed that question right there, you said it's not a place where hope lives, where hope dies. That is the truth. When I was sentenced to life in imprisonment at the age of 18, hope was snuffed out of me. There was no hope. Again, if it wasn't for my queen who told me to turn to God, I would have no hope right now.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process of me pursuing my faith in God, I realized that what we're doing currently here where I'm housed at D.C., shout out to D.C. D.C. got the game right. The director here, he has a progressive mindset. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to make these coffee spaces more equitable, more fair, especially for young people. Mm-hmm. Young people don't have a clue from right to left, right? And so hope for me, hope was my faith. And then, as I said, once I had my faith, education is clear. And then that became my new makeup. I check in here. We have a check-in in the Wyoming community where we give rate our scales, our fitness from 1 to 10. And I intentionally rate in every day at $7.5 billion. I get an attention. So I want to raise the way we think.
Yes.
So I check in at $7.5 billion irregardless of what's going on in my life. It doesn't matter, because mind is over matter. And so I do that to change the narrative and inject that type of sense of hope inside of my young people that I am mentoring inside the program. And so that's what took me out of my dark space. And once I, once I grabbed on education, I didn't let it go.
So how was Joel able to run a successful campaign behind bars? Well, here's a clip from that part of the interview.
I realized that writing takes your voice outside of your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as represented by constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative.
We continue that conversation and more after the break. You're watching Making the Case. It's one thing to be eligible to run for public office, to be able to vote, but it's a whole other thing to run a campaign from behind bars. Remember, this had never been done before, so the logistics were, to say the least, challenging. In the end, though, five people ran and Joel won 30% of the vote.
So tell us how you ran a campaign from inside of a jail cell.
I've been fortunate from a lot of my networks to be able to do a lot of writing. And so I realized that writing takes your voice outside of your immediate space. And so a lot of the articles I wrote allow others to know who Joel Castone is. We have one narrative, but as represented by constituents, we do not want to be defined by a single narrative. And so my narrative supersedes what led me to prison. And so that allowed me to gain or to meet other individuals who were invigorated and inspired by my story. To God be the glory, I would say that there. And then from that point on, I was doing a podcast with my colleagues here, And during the podcast, we were investigating the program, how we can be effective in the podcast. And I discovered that not only can we run for office, excuse me, not only can we vote, but we can also run for office.
Yes.
I cast my name in the ballot. I won. It was a hiccup. You know, I was disqualified for technicality around my address, and I was not responding, even though I thought that it was a missed opportunity, because I feel as though my job is just to be a trailblazer. I'm a trailblazer. As I stated earlier, I'm the first, but I will not be the last. And so I ran again, and I was very inspired by the fact that not only were I running, there were other individuals who wanted to run.
Yes.
That's what it looks like, democracy in action.
So, Joel, I know that an organization called Neighbors for Justice really supported your campaign. Tell me about them.
Yeah, Neighbors for Justice. I met Judy Johnson, who was one of the founders of Neighbors for Justice. They actually were, she was very instrumental in my colleague, Anthony Petty, who was a young man, is a middle-aged guy, said to myself, but it was incarcerated since the age of 16, did 30 years straight, 16, 30 years straight. So Judy Johnson, Neighbors for Justice, was there for Anthony when he came home. And that means a lot to me. And so here we are in the wake of this nation going on a racial reckoning, looking at what went wrong in George Floyd and all the other people of color who were slain unjustly, and people want to get involved. And so here we have a group of people who want to get involved. They reached in and said, we see you as our neighbors, not as a single narrative, but as a neighbor, as a person. And so working with they suggested they were also part of the network system I talked about. And there are so many people. I have to also acknowledge the Pivot Program, Georgetown University Pivot Program, through, led by the leadership of Mark Howard. And Mark Howard also was another remarkable person who allowed my voice to go beyond my four walls limitation, if you will.
Yes.
The thing I met with Mark would allow me to meet Kim Kardashian West. And I didn't beat the glam lady Kim Kardashian West. I didn't beat the billionaire Kim Kardashian West. I met the human being Kim, the homegirl, who came in the inside and said that she wanted to learn. So despite her status and all the mocking things she's doing, like, she came in, brought up in humble and said, I want to learn. And so having an opportunity to meet these individuals allowed me to be able to get my voice out there. And frankly, what you all are doing for today, I'm very humble and thankful for you giving me your time, because I know that our time is our most valuable asset.
We're just so thankful that you've granted this interview to us, so thank you. So besides the support that you received on the outside, what was the support like on the inside, say from staff?
Yeah, I've been aggressive since I've been here. I don't like idle time. that's how you do the time. Time will do you. The old time is saying, you do the time will do you.
Yes.
So that, what that looks like for me is that I'm active in everything that goes down. If it's an education program, sign me up. Sign me up. I'm in everything. So what happened was, by me doing that, my colleagues on the inside, my comrades, the men and the women, I'm going to ask you questions way too. A remarkable thing is happening here. We have co-ed classes. You think of co-ed classes in the inside, like, wait a minute.
Then yeah.
Thank you going on. It's like bells start going off, right? But once again, with Georgetown University, taking classes with not only the male, but also the female incarcerated residents, which I said in my campaign that I want to make sure that I recognize the lives and the voices of the women, because I got an earful from the women. They feel unappreciated. They feel like their voices does not matter. They feel like they're not receiving the same fairness that their male counterparts are feeling. And so being in a class with these young ladies, or many of them like in their 20s, and I'm in my mid-40s, I'm looking at the opportunity that I missed with being with my own daughter. My daughter was, unfortunately, she was born when I was incarcerated. I haven't spent a single day with my daughter. I haven't spent a single day outside of prison with my grandchildren, her children. And so my heart goes out for the women. My queen told me how to respect the dignity of a woman. And so in that class and participating with the school newspaper, a number of the programs on the inside, everyone knows my name. And one of the things that we have inside of DCDOC is the tablet system, the education system, where they have a lot of programs on the tablet. And so that internal communication got the word out. And so I think that probably put me a little bit above some of my competitors in the race. because I had so much content out there. But nonetheless, I say this again. I want to commend those men that ran. I wish it was some women that ran also. Hopefully next time it will be some women that run also. And as I stated, I may be the first, but I will not be the last.
So you just mentioned that you you had others that ran against you for other incarcerated people. What set your campaign apart from theirs?
As I stated, I think probably the content, right? I've been here for quite some time. I afforded me a lot of time here, and I haven't spent my time idle, as I always stated. I'm always active, engaging. I try to recognize humanity in all people. Part of my role is restoring the dignity of correction. I think that correctional people have got a bad rap. You know, sometimes we throw them on the bus too. But they're here trying to do a job just like we're trying to do a job. So I like to look at how can we work harmoniously together. How can we bridge that gap? Because the patient and the physician must be on the same page. They can't be at odds, right? And so we are the patients because we're the inside, and they're the physicians because they're working, coming from the outside, then we have to be, have a harmonious relationship. And so doing that allowed me to meet so many people, and I think that may have gave me a competitive edge, but I can say this here. I was not even worried about whether I won or lost. I was already a winner when I seen how many other people cast their name in the ballot. That's why I ran. I wanted other people to exercise the power that comes with civic engagement. And that's what we need to do. We need to begin able to have civic engagement from the inside that can translate on the outside. If we can think like this on the inside, imagine who people will be once we transition and go home.
Absolutely. So that brings me to my next question. Last year in D.C., lawmakers voted to allow people with felony records who are still in prison to vote. Right now, there are so many restrictive voting laws in so many states. I mean, other than D.C., Vermont, and Maine, so many voting laws on the books that disenfranchise not only the incarcerated community but the returning citizens. Is that sort of the line of work you believe you'll get into once you're released?
Absolutely. Hands down. Because as I stated in the beginning of our interview here, if it wasn't for the work of my predecessors, I would not hold this office right now. And so what D.C. is doing, it has been the vanguard. If you look back in history, the nation's capital has been the vanguard of all the movements inside of the nation. And so I like to say what happens in this city sets the standard for the nation. So enfranchising the incarceration population is a vote for public safety. And so when we do that, again, if you have a person who was once a part of the problem, who was asking for opportunity to be a part of the solution, give that person opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're doing here, even before I was elected into his office, again, child of D.C. DOC, they gave us a seat at the table. And so giving me a seat at the table is saying, hey, let me hear from this guy who has 27 years of incarceration experience, who has been in 16 facilities, who has a proven track record, who has not succumbed to some of the ills that happens inside of the vices that happen inside of incarceration spaces. I don't have any disciplinary reports. I have not been using drugs. Anything that I'm not down to those individuals who may have done so, but I'm only speaking about myself. I haven't done those things. And so now I'm the type of guy who you want at the table. And so we know now, even when we look at what's going on in our nation as relates to ESG and how now corporations can no longer make a file. The SEC, you know, the financial geek, so forgive me this. But the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, have now made it law that when you're filing your, when these companies are doing their quarterly reports, they want to know what are you doing about ESG, environmental and social governance? How are you treating the social ills of the nation? They're being held accountable. And so they saying that we want you to go on the record and doing some good to the community at large. That's what needs to happen in the inside also, and this is what D.C. is doing.
Throughout our conversation, Joel emphasized that his running for office was not just about him. He wanted to inspire others who were incarcerated, the youth on the inside and on the outside who felt and continue to feel hopeless. As we head to break, here's a clip on how Joel hopes to continue inspiring others.
I'm only an investor. That's it. I'm just an investor being used by God's grace. And so if I can inspire anyone and not allow their past to define their future, to not allow that weight of what happened or what may be going on present in their lives to stop them from living out their full potential, then I've done my job.
More of our exclusive interview with the newly elected commissioner when we return.
But no one wants to be here anymore. And can you blame them? Can you blame them?
A hospital system with a team of violence recovery specialists is busy helping victims get back on their feet and feel safe.
For most of the pediatric patients, that now means leaving Chicago.
And tonight's special report, Elizabeth Matthews, has an inside look at the University of Chicago Medical Center program.
You really have to take one patient at a time, because otherwise it would be too daunting. And the work would be too huge.
Jerry Pettis says sometimes her pager goes off multiple times a day. When it does, it means another child has been wounded by violence in Chicago.
The numbers are just staggering, the amount of children that are being shot every day.
Pettis is a pediatric violence recovery specialist for the violence recovery program at Comer Children's Hospital. She helps victims like now 2-month-old Tariana Smith and her mom, Taisha Banks, recover from physical and emotional wounds.
This program has been by my side since day one.
They first came to Comer's July 1st, just hours after Tariana became the city's youngest gunshot victim. At just 4 weeks old, she was shot in the head, sitting in a car seat in her mom's car in Englewood.
When I turned around and seen her, it was just like blood just everywhere, like, and I grabbed her and just held her.
The bullet didn't pierce her brain, but cracked Tariana's skull. She's now recovering well, but the shooting is a stark reminder for Taisha, who 7 years ago was also shot, sitting in a car in Englewood.
I'm completely done with Chicago. I thank the programs and the hospital for placing me somewhere else.
Through the Violence Recovery Program, Pettis is helping this family move out of Chicago, like many of her families are requesting.
I would say the past 4 or 5 months, everyone wants to leave Chicago.
Which is not easy during a pandemic when resources are scarce. Pettis was able to partner with social service agencies to find housing for this family, plus continuing to check in and be a support for Taisha.
She asks me every day, is you all right? How you feel? You know, and that's very important for someone to ask you how you feel.
The VRP program started in 2018 when UChicago Medicine opened its trauma center. So far this year, the program served 1,100 pediatric and adult patients. Team members help victims of violence and their families with crisis intervention, safe discharge planning, and resources for food, housing, and even jobs.
We call it God's work around here, typically and truly.
Dealing with injured children, kids that have become part of a gruesome statistic in the city of Chicago is not for the faint of heart.
Going to the pediatric ICU is a very eerie event every time you go there, because you see infants, you see young children or teenagers, right? And they're helpless and their parents are grieving.
Pettis would love for this program to not be necessary, but reducing the violence, she says, starts with basic building blocks of proper food, education, and health care.
With all those things in place, if we can get there, I think that we'll see the decrease in violence, but right now we're just trying to affect our small corner of the world.
Pettis says her job includes connecting patients with violence intervention programs. She says the reality is sometimes the patients want to retaliate once they are discharged from the hospital. She hopes that through psychoeducation, she can help break that cycle of violence. Elizabeth Matthews, Fox 32, Chicago.
And Chicago police officers are holding a vigil tonight outside the University of Chicago Hospital for the officer wounded.
And we're also learning more about the huge impact Officer Ella French had on the Englewood community. WGN's Mike Lowe is live at the hospital with more on that. Mike?
Micah and Ray, you know, the evening of July 1st was a chaotic one in the city of Chicago. Earlier that afternoon, a 9-year-old girl had been shot in the head, and a WGN crew was at Comer Children's Hospital when we got word of another outrageous shooting. This time, a 1-month-old baby had been wounded in a shooting. And as that baby arrived at the hospital, we noticed a young female Chicago police officer who was there helping to save that baby's life. Today we learned that officer was Ella French. The night of July 1st was memorable for all the wrong reasons. There was a mass shooting in Englewood near 66th and Halsted on a day that had already seen a child shot on the south side. This one left a bullet-riddled vehicle and a 1-month-old, Tariana Smith, in critical condition. Today, as Tariana is recovering, there is a poignant postscript to the story.
She never had a chance to thank her.
We learned that it was Officer Ella French, who played a key role in saving the child's life, rushing the baby to the hospital. Charles McKenzie is the baby's uncle.
So she's like, hey, everything's going to be okay. I got you. We're here together. I'm not going to leave you guys. So it made her feel good, and it made her calm down, too.
The Chicago Police Department confirms that French was the officer who drove the baby to receive life-saving treatment. A WGN camera captured French with the ambulance at Comer Children's Hospital, then escorting Tariana Smith on a gurney to the emergency room. On Saturday night, French was killed in an ambush attack in Englewood, the same neighborhood where she was working to save lives. Community activist Andrew Holmes was there at the hospital on July 1st when Officer French helped save that baby's life, and he remembers speaking with her. Now, he's speaking up for her.
You're looking at our leaders now, they're pointing their fingers at each other, but these people out here pointing guns at each other, and they're letting loose, and they're shooting people. While they sitting there pointing the fingers, the people out here pointing guns. And it's real, whether you live or die.
And in a vigil, a prayer vigil that just wrapped up here across the street from the University of Chicago Hospital, Officer French was remembered as someone who embodied the ideals of the police department of protecting and serving, and someone who really did engage in the spirit of community policing, speaking with and really trying to help the residents of Englewood. We also got an update from a close family friend about Officer French's partner, who is still in surgery tonight. Reporting live in Hyde Park, Mike Lowe, WGN News.
Today, a Cook County judge denies bail for the two brothers charged in the fatal shooting of Chicago police officer Ella French during a traffic stop on Saturday.
Let's go to Gaynor Hall. She's live at the Cook County Criminal Courts building with the latest. Gaynor?
Yeah, and Ben and Lourdes, prosecutors laying out new details today about this traffic stop that ended with gunfire, leaving Officer Ella French dead and her partner critically injured. Saturday night at 63rd and Bell, three Chicago police officers in full uniform approached the gray SUV they pulled over for expired plates. Three people were inside. Prosecutors say 22-year-old Eric Morgan was driving. His brother, 21-year-old Imonte Morgan, was in the back seat, and a woman who has not been charged was in the front passenger seat. Eric initially cooperated, handing his keys over to Officer Ella French, but authorities say Imonte got out of the car with a drink in one hand and a cell phone in the other, and after he refused to set the items down, he struggled with officers. While that was happening, Eric ran. One of the officers chased him. And back at the vehicle, prosecutors say Imonte opened fire, fatally shooting Officer French in the head. A second officer, who remains in critical condition, was shot three times in the eye and the shoulder and has a bullet lodged in his brain. Prosecutors noting both officers still had their guns holstered and their body cameras were rolling.
Defendant Monte Morgan is seen on video emerging from that passenger compartment holding a gun in his left hand. He is seen looking around while standing above those officers. He then moves off of camera, and after several moments, he can be seen on victim two's camera coming back into view and stepping over the bodies of those officers as they lay in the street.
After hearing the gunshots and not hearing his partners on the radio, the third officer stopped trying to handcuff Eric Morgan and ran back. Prosecutors say Imonte gave the gun to his brother. The third officer shot Imonte in the abdomen. Eric kept running, hopped a fence into a yard, and residents held him down until police arrived. Imonte Morgan, who remains hospitalized, is charged with Officer French's murder and several other charges, including attempted murder. He was on probation in Cook County for robbery. His brother, who faces weapons charges, is on probation for a theft charge in Wisconsin. And in another development, a source tells WGN Investigates the mother of the men was herself arrested this morning during an altercation with security and police at Christ Medical Center. Oak Lawn police confirmed the arrest, but charges have not yet been filed. A third man, Jamel Danzy from Indiana, is facing federal charges for straw purchasing the gun, and prosecutors say the SUV was registered to him. Chicago police officers packed the courtrooms for today's hearings, with the FOP president saying elected officials need to do better.
The men and women of this police department know what's going on. They are absolutely disgusted with the leadership that has presented itself in the last 72 hours. It is hard not to make it about that, but this is still about Ella and her partner, who is still fighting for his life.
Prosecutors say both brothers gave videotaped statements, funeral arrangements for Officer Ella French still being finalized today, and her partner was set to undergo surgery this afternoon. Reporting live outside the Layton Criminal Courthouse, Gaynor Hall, WGN News.
Well, good morning. Vigils across the city once again last night for Officer French and her partner, who is still here at the hospital recovering, all while Superintendent David Brown expressed his outrage at a federal judge. While bagpipes played, more than 200 people bowed their heads in prayer.
Today, as a community, we grieve.
Last night, they gathered outside the 22nd Police District headquarters in Morgan Park to honor and remember.
It is not how these officers died that made them heroes, but how they lived.
And that is how we should always remember Ella.
The crowd, made up of cops, CPD families, and a community hurting, offered their condolences, but also their hopes that better days are ahead.
If something like this happens to someone like her, and it doesn't make people kind of wake up and at least, you know, take a look at what's going on, I don't know what would.
Last Saturday in West Englewood, a struggle during a traffic stop led to Officer Ella French and her partner being shot. French died from her wound, her partner critically injured.
He's not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination, so we just got to keep praying for him, that's all.
Prosecutors say 21-year-old Amante Morgan pulled the trigger. His 22-year-old brother Eric, who was driving that night, tried to get rid of the gun used. A gun, federal prosecutors say, was bought legally by 29-year-old Jamel Danzy from Hammond, Indiana, but as a straw purchase. They say he sold it to one of the Morgan brothers who couldn't legally buy a firearm. A federal judge released Danzy on a $4,500 unsecured bond, a decision blasted by Superintendent David Brown, who said in a written statement, quote, "It is an outrage. This decision sets a dangerous precedent that straw purchasers like Danzy are not a danger to society, despite the fact that his alleged actions directly led to a murder of a Chicago police officer and left another in critical condition."
Brown called Danzy's release a disservice to the entire Chicago Police Department. We are at the University of Chicago Medical Center. I'm Eric Rung, WGN News.
There are several neighborhood prayer vigils for the police officer. WGN's Mike Lowe is at one in Morgan Park on the south side. Mike.
Ray and Micah, they are setting up behind me for a prayer vigil that will get underway in about an hour and a half here just outside of the 22nd District here in Morgan Park. We're expected to hear from the head of the Police Memorial Foundation as well as the Chicago Police Department chaplain. Now, earlier today, the man who's accused of illegally buying the gun that was used to kill Officer Ella French appeared in federal court.
The most important thing is that we honor her service, we support her mom and her brother, and that we pray every day for the other officer who was injured and still hospitalized and his family.
As Mayor Lori Lightfoot reflected on the life of fallen Chicago police officer Ella French,
by all accounts, Ella French was an incredible person.
The Indiana man who allegedly purchased the gun used to kill Officer French and wound her partner appeared in federal court. 29-year-old Jamel Danzy of Hammond, Indiana, is accused of making a straw purchase, the process of illegally buying a gun for someone else. Authorities say he bought this gun in Hammond, Indiana, back in March for one of the two Chicago brothers accused in the killing. A federal judge today released Danzy on a $4,500 unsecured bond, court supervision, and conditions to have no contact with the officers' families.
A man responsible for murder and attempted murder of a peace officer. Disappointed to hear that.
Alderman Matt O'Shea says everyone involved in the killing must be held accountable. He has organized a prayer vigil for his Southside community tonight.
I would hope that somehow, some way, this could bring our city together to heal, to support our police.
Also today, French's partner continued to recover at the University of Chicago Medical Center after undergoing what was described as a complicated surgery last night.
He's still got a long road ahead of him.
And Mayor Lori Lightfoot says the focus should be on that wounded officer and on Ella French.
She exhibited, I think, all the attributes that we really want young people to do, which is dedication, commitment, hard work, service over self, a lot of sacrifice. Her mother said it, that she loved the job.
And Alderman O'Shea says he expects police, officers, families, and neighbors from here in the Morgan Park neighborhood to attend tonight's vigil, which he says he hopes will be an uplifting experience in a rather difficult week. Reporting live in Morgan Park, Mike Lowe, WGN News.
It was a particularly violent holiday weekend in Chicago, and that in turn has prompted a round of finger pointing and calls for fresh solutions. Amanda Vinicky joins us now with more. Amanda.
Paris, more than 100 people shot, children, two police officers, at least 17 individuals dying as a result. The 4th of July, of course, traditionally a time for flag waving, barbecuing, and fireworks. But unfortunately, in Chicago, it has also become known as one of the most violent weekends of the year. And this weekend's shootings top that even of recent years. There's a horrifying fact that Mayor Lori Lightfoot acknowledged today, saying that some neighborhoods are under siege.
And I want to specifically speak to the victims and survivors. I want you to know that we are doing absolutely everything that we can to stem the violence. I've met with many of you, and I've heard your pain and anguish. And I carry that with me. We must do better, all of us, for you.
Now, it is possible that the stats could have been even worse, CPD Superintendent David Brown describing a concerning case in which a member of the cleanup crew, an employee that is, at a hotel near Navy Pier, it's one overlooking the Ohio Street beach, noticed a gun in a man's room. Officers investigated and did find a rifle, a handgun, and magazines. An Iowa man with no previous criminal history has been charged with two counts of unlawful aggravated use of a weapon. Now, as for the shootings that did occur, Brown says CPD officers did their part, taking some 244 illegal guns off the streets.
We can take guns off the street. We can charge people with murder. But again, I want to ask you a question in this gallery. How many people think it's okay to have over 90 people on electronic monitoring that we've charged with murder, released back to our communities?
Putting the blame on the courts is similar to the argument that Brown made Friday to members of City Council when older people held a special six-hour-long meeting grilling Brown on the CPD's strategy for preventing a weekend like this one turned out to be. Cook County Chief Circuit Judge Tim Evans has largely been quiet in the face of these allegations from both Brown and the mayor, but today he did release a statement saying, looking at individual tragic cases in isolation may contribute to the speculation that releasing individuals before trial, that rather than incarcerating them, whether by placing them on electronic monitoring or other means of supervision, means an increase in crime, Evans said. But speculation based on isolated cases is not the same as reality based on a complete picture. And research has shown that bail reform has not led to an increase in crime. Evans pointing to a study from Loyola University researchers that found the same conclusion. Now, in the face of all of this, alderpersons and community leaders have their own theories and demands. Leaders from Chinatown say their close-knit community is reeling after a drive-by shooting yesterday.
The increase of crimes and violence have not only threatened our safety in life, but also caused the mental health problems in our community, including fear, anxiety, stress, even suicide. People are scared of going out, afraid of going to work, go shopping, and go exercising.
She is among the local leaders who are calling for additional funding from the city and the state, also from the feds, to go toward community needs, including mental health. She says the Midwest Asian Health Association could use that extra money to hire a psychiatrist and help with some of those mental health needs. Meanwhile, you have Pastor Marvin Hunter. He is the great uncle of Laquan McDonald, who was killed by a Chicago policeman in 2017, calling on the federal government to send money to Chicago, but not to the city itself. He says it needs to go directly toward grassroots organizations and leaders with whom President Biden himself should engage. Now, the president will be in Illinois tomorrow, but he's heading to McHenry County.
I think that the president should absolutely not go to Crystal Lake. I think he should come to North Lawndale because the crime is at epidemic proportions in North Lawndale. I think that the people of Englewood and the people of North Lawndale and Humboldt Park and East and West Garfield and Roseland should all meet there, and they should meet there because he's there to have a real conversation about how do we turn this around.
We do plan to cover and be at Biden's visit. Whether reporters will have an opportunity to ask him about violence is unclear, but he is expected to meet with Mayor Lightfoot, and surely this will come up. By the way, Chicago's numbers, of course, shocking, but a superintendent did point out other cities are also seeing what he described as violent crime waves. With that, Paris, back to you.
Amanda, really quickly, just to follow up, the Superintendent Brown said 90 people have been arrested that for murder that were out on electronic monitoring?
That was what he said, but he did not necessarily give a time frame for those arrests from my recollection.
And it would have to be over multiple years, you would think. All right, we'll have to follow up on that. Amanda, thank you so much. And tomorrow night we'll have a conversation with Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox and others about the release of crime suspects back in the communities while awaiting trial.
The city's crime statistics for July paint a disturbing picture. Chicago saw a 51% increase in murders over the last year.
Murders here in Chicago spiked by more than 37%.
Murders were up an astounding 83%.
The percent increase in murder here is 2.5 times more than the national average.
And shooting incidents were up 96%.
And when you look at this past week alone, murders were up 286% and shootings were up 193%.
Well, there is a spike in violence across the city this weekend. Among the wounded, an off-duty firefighter shot in Albany Park.
Three women were shot in Avondale Park.
A three-year-old shot in the chest last night is now recovering in the hospital.
For the fourth straight weekend, children are among the shooting victims. At least 60 people have been shot, 9 of them killed.
2 children were killed by gunfire, and those children now among 14 people killed this weekend, a total of 77 people shot. Tragically, this now makes 9 children killed in the city of Chicago over the past 3 weekends. That's since Father's Day weekend.
A man was killed. A 17-year-old and a 14-year-old were wounded in a shooting late last night at an Inglewood gas station.
This is not because I don't have a job. No, this is because I got an attitude with you or a problem with you, or we done argued about something.
When asked why murders and shootings are up in Chicago,
that's a complicated question to answer, but
one the mayor says is a perfect storm of almost 3 months of COVID-19, concern about the spread of the disease, and some law enforcement components being out of the mix. She also returned to a familiar refrain.
We have way too many guns on the street.
Helen, for law enforcement in Chicago, the resurgence of looting this week has created an all-hands-on-deck situation, with the FBI tonight zeroing in on several aspects of apparently organized attacks.
Overnight, chaos in the streets of Chicago. Looting taking place around the city.
Just woke up to a huge explosion. That's the Nordstrom.
Images posted on social media showing store windows broken, intense police presence, and fires.
This new video of early Monday looting. Women with a lug wrench bashing in a window at the Pink Store by Victoria's Secret, which is on the fourth floor of the famous Water Tower Place. Authorities now zeroing in on this woman and her alleged accomplice. The front door then unlocked for 2 more unidentified women to walk in.
Now this is what things look like right around 1 o'clock this morning. Among the stores that were hit is this Foot Locker on Milwaukee near Ashland. Now despite the store being boarded up, looters managed to remove those panels, bust through the glass windows, and then the metal gate to make their way into the store.
Well-organized posses of looters used rental trucks to haul away items from stores.
The rear of the building trashed as shoeboxes littered the ground. And then, of course, this Target here on Division in Ashland also hit. We spotted a man creeping through the store in the dark. Someone also could be seen standing in the store's doorway with a Target basket in his hand. Garfield's Beverage Express ransacked.
FBI officials here tonight tell the I-team they are working with local law enforcement to identify actors instigating and conducting violent criminal activity. The aim is to put names with faces. In Chicago, just Bank of America alone has been hit by ATM looters more than 36 times this summer, most of them in the first go-around a couple months ago. 37 ATMs damaged, according to a Bank of America spokesperson. and federal agents have jurisdiction over the ATM attacks Monday, as they did with similar crimes during the Chicago riots in late May and early June. Social media messages, including this one, went out Sunday to encourage a downtown plunder at midnight. CPD's once robust practice of using social media monitoring software is now tapped less frequently because of lawsuits filed by civil liberties organizations alleging the department was spying on activity protected by the First Amendment. Homeowners don't feel safe in Chicago. That's the message tonight from a prominent property management group following Sunday's mayhem that followed the chaos in May. In this letter, Sudler Property Management President Stephen Levy tonight tells Mayor Lightfoot that their 38,000 residents in more than 100 condos do not feel safe, and neither do their employees, that they are avoiding walks after 6 p.m. and standing near windows. According to Levy, this is not a way to live, and I can't fault homeowners when they tell me they're considering leaving Chicago.
Tonight, Northwestern medicine researchers working to prove early study results suggesting there may be a COVID-19 virus strain unique to Chicago.
It suggests that maybe this version of the virus is one that is centered around the Chicago area.
Genetic samples taken from Chicago COVID-19 patients uncovered three different major virus strains, including the predominant strain centered in New York, impacting people globally. But the strain found more abundantly in city patients was rare, unique to Chicago.
We sequenced 88 isolates from 88 different patients early on in the Chicago pandemic.
Dr. Egan Ozer, lead researcher on the Northwestern Medicine Study, said they found differences between those impacted by the New York-centered strain versus the Chicago one.
They had more virus in their airways compared to patients on average that had the more Chicago-centered virus.
Mayor Lightfoot also says the city will reinstate some COVID-19 restrictions to help combat the recent rise in cases. The rollbacks include bars without food going back to outdoor service only, restaurants taking parties of six or less, and fitness classes allowing a maximum of 10 people only.
Those things will be available until close of business tomorrow.
They've made the call to close because of barely any warm outdoor seating.
A last hug shared between customers outside Lakeview's Redmond Ale House. The popular Northside Sports Bar doors close for good.
U10 Ruth's Chris Restaurant in Chicago is closing for good.
Tuscany Restaurant is now pivoting sales strategies, selling items half price. The group that owns it took conference calls for hours today trying to figure out next steps. At seven restaurants,
some that were, potentially going to be closing for good come Monday.
Eight others were already closed.
And so we were barely surviving. We cut our losses the past couple months, and that was during the summer months.
Also tonight, major layoffs hitting several Chicago area companies. According to the Warren Report, more than 800 jobs are involved. Aramark Loyola, the food service company, started laying off people last week. About 240 permanent jobs will be lost there. In less than 2 weeks, Hollywood Casino Joliet will slash 68 jobs. In November, America Hotel Register in Vernon Hills will cut more than 300 jobs. That's a third of its workforce.
Many of the businesses that were looted are still boarded up, like this Target behind me, temporarily closed. And the big question is when, or in some cases, even if stores will reopen.
For 2.5 months of being closed due to the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Chicago now allowed to open again, but it may not happen. Let me show you why. We're here downtown on the Mag Mile. You can see so many businesses here still boarded up because of all the looting that we've had over past days.
Consequences to rioting and looting downtown. One business is leaving and another could leave Water Tower Place.
Well, it's no secret that big box stores like Macy's have been hurting in recent years. What happened on Sunday certainly isn't helping things. And when you add COVID-19 into the mix, many wonder if this could be the 1-2 punch that puts an end to businesses here. One of the flagship stores along the Mag Mile. Today, Mayor Lori Lightfoot confirming Macy's is likely leaving Water Tower Place.
This is such a shame, and there is help in this city. You don't have to take anything from anybody. All you have to do is work together.
United Airlines is also relocating a key team from its world headquarters in Willis Tower to its Elk Grove facility in response to the civil unrest in Chicago.
If Macy's leaves Water Tower, that will be a significant blow. I'm sure the folks at Water Tower are looking at trying to attract as many other prospective folks to lease their spaces there.
This scene at River Oaks Shopping Center in Calumet City. On Sunday, SkyCam 9 overhead at Grand Boulevard Plaza at 55th and the Dan Ryan, where there are some big-name stores, but most here are mom and pop.
This whole parking lot was filled.
Jamal Burris was inside his fitness center when the looting began.
All of a sudden, I just heard a bunch of yelling, screaming. I heard these windows breaking. I heard banging on the walls here.
Today, a plea on social media brought in reinforcements to board up his storefront, and he went the extra step to leave a message to would-be looters.
And the reason that I spray painted black owned right here and then Black Lives Matter to my left and your right is because, according to them, this is the reason that they're doing this. But we all know that it's not. It's opportunistic looters. Maybe it'll help as a deterrent. Maybe they'll think, okay, this is a black-owned business. Maybe we should leave them alone. So maybe there'll be some kind of code, hopefully.
On the southeast side.
This is a sad day. It's a sad day.
Nathaniel Pendleton's restaurant was hit. The father of Hydea Pendleton pleading now for violence and looting to stop.
We're trying to make something better in our neighborhoods.
And as so many today are now boarding up, others who were spared this weekend are clearing out what they have left, including roller skates. Preservation to someday roll on.
It breaks me up because I was born here, raised here, and there's really no reason why we tearing up our own community.
You can see in the surveillance video windows being broken out during the chaos in Chicago's South Loop late Saturday night. Looters ducking in to take what they can.
I could see the glass being completely just shattered, blown out by some object that they threw through the window.
Owner Adrian Alvarez and her husband compelled to come to their Orange Theory Fitness franchise in the early hours of Sunday morning.
We weren't necessarily trying to defend the business, but we wanted to go clean up. We wanted to let people know we were in support. We wanted to just be there.
But as her husband Ralph was trying to clean up outside, Alvarez says she turned to see him on the ground in front of a large crowd, unconscious.
I started to scream. I tried to wake him. He wouldn't wake back up. And I tried to call for the police. No one was picking up. I tried to call from the phone in there. No one was picking up. And people just kept coming by and just looking at him, and I wanted him to wake up.
When she went to help him, that's when she says she was attacked.
A woman came out of nowhere and hit me over the back with the crowbar.
Alvarez finally got through to 911 on her cell phone. She says her husband was taken to Stroger Hospital with a serious head injury.
The people that did this, the people that I saw, they weren't protesters. Protesters have a cause. This is a struggle. We're angry. We're angry at what is happening. But this is our city. They're tearing, whoever this is, looters, they are tearing it down.
From the city's central business district, where nearly every pharmacy, grocery, and convenience store remains closed, to the south and west sides of Chicago, residents already hit hard by the state's stay-at-home order are now having a hard time meeting their most basic needs.
Just everything, my blood pressure, my pain medication, my statin, you know, those are the three major medication that I get.
77-year-old Norma Bradley lives across the street from the Walgreens on 79th Street in Racine. It was, along with several other businesses in the area, severely damaged following this weekend's looting. It is now closed, as are seven of the chain's other eight stores in a three-mile radius.
We got three senior homes right here in walking distance, and this is the only way they can get to their medicine.
For those living in areas that are already food deserts, who have had to fight to get chains like Walmart and Whole Foods to come in, the worry is, will these stores want to reopen even after things stabilize?
You shut down with those few stores that are in the community,
How long can people go on with that? How desperate do people get after that?
I really don't know, and this is, it's just hurting. It's hurting me because I love this neighborhood. A lot of people have left it, but I'm not leaving it.
To get it fixed.
And people are up and leaving Illinois, one of the highest rates in the United States.
Tia is back taking a closer look at this.
I don't think a lot of people are shocked by this, but still very stunning when you look at the reasons why. No state lost a bigger chunk of income in 2019 than Illinois. $6 billion of earnings flowed elsewhere as more than 80,000 residents completely left the state. This is from an analysis of IRS statistics put together by WirePoint. Illinois, West Virginia, and Mississippi are the only states that lost population over the past decade. Where are those people and their tax dollars going? Florida, Texas, and also Arizona. Florida actually gained almost $18 billion in income in 2019. WirePoint predicts the rush to get out of our state will continue as long as Springfield refuses to pursue meaningful spending and pension reforms. Our political editor, Mike Flannery, did ask the governor about this in a one-on-one interview today.
Illinois has been going through this terrible situation for really decades now, where there's been a lack of attention to truly balancing the budget, to focusing on paying down debt, making sure that we have our fiscal situation in order, and attracting businesses.
Well, Pritzker also says he aims to do all those things while also paying public employees the retirement benefits they expect to collect.
Now, we got a lot of things, a lot of racism going on in the world right now. Who's more racist, black people or white people? Black people. You know why? Because we hate black people, too. Everything white people don't like about black people really don't like about black people. There's some shit going on with black people right now. It's like a civil war going on with black people. And there's two sides. It's black people and there's niggas. And niggas have got to go. Every time black people want to have a good time, ignorant-ass niggas fuck it up. Can't do shit. Can't do shit without some ignorant-ass niggas fucking it up. Can't do nothing. Can't keep a disco open more than 3 weeks. Grand opening, grand closing. Can't go to a movie the first week it come out. Why? Because niggas are shooting at the screen. What kind of ignorant shit is that? Hey, that's a good movie. That's so good I got to bust a cap in here. Hey, I love black people, but I hate niggas, boy. Oh, I hate niggas. Boy, I wish they let me join the Ku Klux Klan. Shit, I do a drive-by from here to Brooklyn. Tired of niggas, man. You can't have shit when you're around niggas. You can't have shit. You can't have no big screen TV. You can have it, but you better move it in at 3 in the morning. Painted white, hope niggas think it's a bassinet. Can't have shit in your house. Why? Because niggas will break in your house. Niggas will live next door to you, break in your house, and come over the next day and go, I heard you got robbed. You robbed me. You ain't hear shit because you was doing shit. Damn. Tired of niggas. Tired of niggas, man. Damn, man. You know what the worst thing about niggas? Niggas always want some credit for some shit they supposed to do. For some shit they just supposed to do. A nigga will brag about some shit a normal man just does. A nigga will say some shit like, I take care of my kids. You're supposed to, you dumb motherfucker. What are you talking about? What are you bragging about? What kind of ignorant shit is that? I ain't never been to jail. What, you want a cookie? You're not supposed to go to jail. No expectation as a motherfucker. Fuck, man. I'm tired of this shit. You know the worst thing about niggas? The worst thing about niggas? Niggas love to not know. Nothing make a nigga happier than not knowing the answer to your question. Just ask a nigga a question. Any nigga. Hey, nigga, what's the capital of Zaire? I don't know that shit. Keep it real. Niggas love to keep it real. Real dumb. Niggas hate knowledge. Shit. So I tell you, niggas are breaking your house. You want to save your money? Put it in your books. Because niggas don't read. Then put the money in the books. Shit, books are like kryptonite to a nigga. Here's a book. No! No! Not a book! No! No! Tired of this shit, man. Your kids can't fucking play nowhere. Every year the space gets smaller. Okay, you go from that corner to that corner. Oh, you go from that gate to that gate. By the time motherfuckers 10, he's just hopping in the circle, like. Tired of this shit, man. Tired, tired, tired. Be 5'4", bigger boy, I hate a nigga. Boy, tired of this shit, man. Tired, man. Niggas is ignorant, love being ignorant, singing about ignorance. I heard some song the other day. It's the first of the month. Niggas are singing welfare carols. On the first day of welfare, my true love gave to me. I wish you a merry welfare and a happy food stamp. The fuck is going on? What the fuck is going on? Now they got some shit they're trying to get rid of welfare. No, every time you see welfare in the news, they always show black people. Black people don't give a fuck about welfare. Niggas are shaking in their boots. Or they gonna take our shit. Shit, a black man that got two jobs, going to work every day, hacks a nigga on welfare. Like, nigga, get a job. I got two, you can't get one? I wish you'd be laying the ass for the mine. But if you get fucked up and get laid off, they wouldn't have another nigga for 10 years. Shit, a black woman that got two kids going to work every day, busting her ass, hates a bitch with 9 kids getting a welfare check. Like, bitch, stop fucking. Stop fucking. Stop it. Put the dick down. Put it down. Get a job. Yes, you can get a job. And get a job holding dicks. Whatever you do, prepare to do it.
Told me about Declaration of Independence. Just my English was so bad, I couldn't understand. He just read to me very slowly. We held those truths to be self-evident. What? All men are created equal. What do you mean? Well, Lily, you are a woman, you are Chinese, you have yellow skin, but you are creators. Daughter and son, your rights come from God, not from your government. You have an individual right. Nobody can take away from you. That's in American's founding document. My light bulb just came on. I never heard of individual right. I have a right, me, by myself, not from my government. You know what? Next time when I went back to see him, I refused to register. My light bulb will not turn off. It's like I found some critical term called individual right from God.
But no one wants to be here anymore. And can you blame them? Can you blame them?
A hospital system with a team of violence recovery specialists is busy helping victims get back on their feet and feel safe.
For most of the pediatric patients, that now means leaving Chicago.
And tonight's special report, Elizabeth Matthews, has an inside look at the University of Chicago Medical Center program.
You really have to take one patient at a time, because otherwise it would be too daunting. And the work would be too huge.
Jerry Pettis says sometimes her pager goes off multiple times a day. When it does, it means another child has been...
Adams became an example for many of what they say is a broken welfare system here in America. And now Angel is facing eviction, and once again, she is demanding someone else pay. News Channel 8's Jeff Patterson joining us now live from the Hillsborough County Courthouse, where Adams was in front of a judge again today. Jeff?
Yeah, good evening, Rod. Angel was back in court today. Angel Adams, now Angel Brown, became very famous. And actually, out of all of the stories I've ever done at News Channel 8, she's the one most people talk about. She's the one most people remember, all because of one phrase she uttered when I first met her.
Somebody needs to be held accountable, and they need to pay.
When I first met Angel, she was living in a one-bedroom motel. 12 of her children were sharing just two beds, and Angel demanded that someone pay for her to move into a new house. With the help of the Department of Children and Families, Angel moved into a new home. But when someone posted stories about her on YouTube, she became internationally famous as an example of what is wrong with the welfare system in America. Angel doesn't care that people across the country hate her.
That's okay because they don't know me.
Now Angel and her husband are back in trouble and back in court.
Our lights go on, they go off. They go on, they go off.
Angel is facing eviction from her home, and her power has been turned off because they owe nearly $600 in back payments. Angel told the judge she used a check from the Tampa Housing Authority that was to pay for the power bill to pay instead to evacuate her children during Hurricane Irma.
And I used it for my children to evacuate for the Irma hurricane. When they told us to get out, I used that money to evacuate and get my children where they needed to be.
The judge told Angel and her husband the bill is theirs to pay.
You're asking me to make an agency pay money above and beyond what they committed to pay, and I don't have that authority.
And so Angel is facing eviction once again from this home. The landlord has not been paid rent in 3 months, and Angel is wondering where now to turn.
My children are hungry. My children are afraid. My children are cold. My children can't function in school. My children, they're not doing very well at all.
Yeah, the Tampa Housing Authority is working with Angel to try to find her and her husband and her children a new house. But here's an update on Angel. When I first met her 10 years ago, she had 15 children. 12 of them were living with her. Now she has 17 children. 5 of them are living outside of the home. And the question everyone always asks, why does she have so many children if she can't pay for them? And the one thing Angel has always maintained, she says, children are a gift from God. Rod?
All right. Jeff Patterson reported live for us tonight. Jeff, thanks.
And today's podcast is titled Chicago, the Wild West 2.0. And that last story was out of Tampa, but there's an Angel Adams or Angel Brown in every urban city. You got Angel Adamses or Angel Browns in Chicago, too. However, as in one of the audios we played earlier, people are leaving Chicago for, well, crime is one reason. It's a, to my knowledge, it's a very highly regulated city. So, you know, people moving to, you know, when it's regulated, you know, everything's just more expensive. It's a ripple effect. In any event, but it'd be interesting to see where they're moving to. Now, I know of, you know, maybe a couple of people that have moved from Chicago to other parts of the state. Not too far from Chicago, maybe an hour and a half away, some people 2 hours away. Then you have some people that are moving. I've talked to people in the this year at least, that have moved or are in the process of moving to places like Alabama. One person is contemplating on moving to Arizona. So in any event, if you got any opinions on Chicago, being the, well, you know, there's a mixed thing about when you use the term Wild West. Wild West implies frontier. So although Chicago might have a lot of violence, which they, you know, had during the Wild West and various parts of the Wild West, but the Wild West really wasn't regulated. Wild West, frontier country was basically off the grid, meaning very little government regulation. So although Chicago has a lot of violence, there's a lot of government regulation in Chicago, which wouldn't put it in the frontier category. But that's driving people out to explore more or less regulated places, of which some people, depending on where they're going to move, they're going to have to develop new skill sets. And some people don't want to do that. They, you know, we're grown up in the age, well, at least baby boomers, a lot of baby boomers. We've grown up in an age of comfort and conveniences. If you live in a city, you know, like a place like New York City, you really don't need a car. You know, you got the comfort and convenience. You got the city, well, let me speak from a D.C. perspective. D.C., depending on where you live in the D.C. metro area, you basically don't need a car. Some place that you live in, everything you need is within walking distance. And I'm talking about a Walmart, a grocery store. Well, a lot of Walmarts have grocery stores within them now. 7-Elevens, McDonald's, Five Guys, a subway system that'll take you all the way to the airport. And they're working on getting it out to two airports. I don't know if the Purple Line goes out to Dulles Airport yet, but they're working on it, if it's not already completed. Taxi cabs, now you got Uber, Lyft, with these apps that they'll bring groceries to, I mean Instacart, they'll bring groceries to your front door now. 7-Eleven, as we learned from Robin yesterday, 7-Eleven has an app where they'll bring stuff from 7-Eleven to your front door. A lot of restaurants now with DoorDash, Uber Eats, your favorite restaurant or carryout delivers, you know, stuff to your front door now. So you got a lot of comfort and conveniences, and a lot of people they don't want to leave that. They don't want to leave that. So, however, you know, there's a trickle in certain areas to move to more remote places. And in these more remote or rural places, you're not going to have a city bus line. You're definitely not going to have a subway system. But you have a lot of people that are working from their homes, and you might live in an area that could be rural or semi-rural, let's call it the exurbs, where you're away from a densely populated area. However, within a 20 or 30 minute drive, you can get to a more densely populated area and some of these people, you know what, I'm sure people are developing apps, and I'll give an example. When I was out in Oklahoma, last time I was out that way, I wanted to go to another town in Oklahoma. It was a historically black town, and they didn't have, it was about 30 minutes away. They didn't have any public transit. There were no cabs that went that way. There were no bus lines that went that way. Obviously, no subway. And I was in Muskogee, Oklahoma, town 30 minutes away. Greyhound didn't go that way. And, of course, there's no Amtrak or nothing. But there's going to be entrepreneurs, if they're not already, that are going to say, you know what, there's a bunch of people that would like to go to this particular location, and they're going to start, you know what, if I was driving out that way, I would set up a business, and we would just make runs from Muskogee to, you know, these satellite towns that are like within a 30-mile radius. You can make a pretty nice living that way. In any event, going back to our title for today, Chicago, the Wild West, if you got any take on it. Last time I was up there, which was about a little bit over two years ago, I flew into Chicago, met somebody in Chicago, met a couple of people in Chicago, but then we traveled about 45 minutes to an hour outside of Chicago to look at opportunities in a rural area of the state of Illinois. However, not far from that location, you got, Indiana, and I even know of people that live in Chicago proper, but they found opportunity two states over. They live in Chicago, but their business is in Ohio. And these are, I guess you would classify these people as millennials. But anyway, I'm going to see if I can get them on here one day as well. In any event, 314, what do you think about the Wild West 2.0 in Chicago?
I think those people are acting like pure savages.
Well, many people would agree with you.
Well, when you have looked at carrying on by groups of people before in the past, they were labeled savages.
Yes. And what do you think is the root cause of all this?
The ones that you are witnessing, they are doing savage things. And you know that guy that's putting painting black on business on this storefront.
I don't think
that's going
to do any good.
Well, see, I'm going to tell you how long this crap's been going on. Because it was black businesses that done the same thing back in Chicago in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
They was painting black-owned business on these stores, and they still got tore up. Matter of fact, a famous character was in the Illinois National Guard, and a picture of him in front of one of these stores was shot. That person was Gale Sayers. He's a famous running back for the Chicago Bears.
Mm-hmm. You know, I saw him once, and where was I? Peoria, Illinois. This was when I was in college. We went down for breakfast, and then like we were on the first ones there. But Gale was in there first, sitting down. He was the athletic director at Southern Illinois University Carbondale.
That's down there by Carbondale. Yeah, it's down there close to me.
Well, yeah, we had to fly into St. Louis. We had to fly into St. Louis and get the airport and then take, we had to rent cars to get over to Carbondale.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I done work. I built some buildings over there for SAU.
Okay.
Sometimes back. I forget which ones they were. Can't keep up with all this stuff. But no, this is just terrible. And then when you look at the stats on the shootings and killings from Memorial Day weekend in 2020 until and through Monday, May the 31st, 2021, They had shot 4,845 blacks.
That's a lot of
killing. 745. 745 murders. 4,845 shots. And since Memorial Day weekend, May the 28th, May the 31st of 2021, through just this past Sunday, the other day, August the 8th, you know, I had 1,331 blacks shot by other blacks in a total of 69 days with 180 murders. What do you call that? Ain't no white police shot nobody. Why
would? No Klansmen.
No Klansmen. No Thomas Jefferson.
That's a significant number because if you look at, you know, some of these little towns I've been to over the last few years, you know, like Taft's got 250 people. Some of them, like some of Oklahoma, might have 100 people. Right.
Everybody in Taft will be walking around with a cane.
Right. There are more people, blacks are killing more blacks than, because a lot of us get upset with, you know, Black Wall Street. But these numbers dwarf whatever happened with Black Wall Street.
Black Wall Street was Creek Indians. It was not black African Americans. It might have been a few, but overall those are Creek Indians. So we can't say it. Put those in the same perspective. Rihanna is a Barbados. She's not a black American. You can't put them in the same perspective. Between 1899 and 1921, you had 3,436 people lynched. That's 22 years. Hell, these numbers, it's overshadowing them. And this is for the last 2 years I've been keeping up with it. Because some fool going to tell me only black folks shoot black folks and white shoot white. Ain't nowhere in the country that white folks shooting each other like this. And they wouldn't stand for it. And
well,
blacks run from this. Things. I don't blame them. Like your video, skits, was talking about how blacks run from this. And I really enjoy the stand-up comic. There are niggas and there are blacks.
It is a distinction.
And I don't blame Africans for kicking their butts out the country. As the British kicked out convicts and put them on the island of the continent of Australia. You get rid of them damn riffraff. If not, they have your whole damn country rotten. That's who you should be getting reparations from, them fools.
Now, let's stick to Chicago. What do you think the root cause in Chicago is with all this? Because typically the people that
I can tell you what it ain't. Let's talk about what it ain't. Let's talk about what it ain't. You got a black mayor, so it ain't that.
No, no.
Not only is she
black,
but she's, quote unquote, she's progressive. She's an openly gay lesbian, 4'2", somewhere about. And she's got about a 7-foot-tall white female husband. So it ain't that. That's a that there is an all encompassing
correction, Bianchi. They refer to each other as wives. That's this, you know, because they're same sex.
Well, I can only look at what I can see.
Okay. All right.
Then let's go on a little bit further. Whoa, wait a minute. The superintendent of the police, he's black. And have been for quite some time, a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then let's go a little bit further. The second in command for the whole state of Illinois is a black female, and I can't think of her name. She's a lieutenant governor. Your head cop, your number one prosecutor in the state, the attorney general, Mr. Muhammad, he's black. Cook County, the county by which Chicago sits in, the prosecutor, Kim Fox, who for some reason or another won't prosecute Jesse Smollett, she's a black female. Your Secretary of State, who handles all the voting issues, ballots and so forth. He's a black male.
And the lieutenant governor of Illinois, I'm glad you brought that up, is Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. You're right, she's a black woman.
So it ain't got nothing to do with representation. We need somebody that look like us who's going to govern like us. Ain't got nothing to do with that, apparently.
You're right. Plenty of blacks in power.
You know, there's 10 elite black communities. Number 10 is Cedar Hill in Texas, 52% black, $90,000 a year income. Randalltown, Maryland, 81% black, $100,000 a year income. Stone Mountain Village, Georgia, 62% black, $107,000 income. Florissant, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis. Now, St. Louis don't got so bad. It had ran decent red-blooded American blacks out of St. Louis into what was at one time all-white Florissant.
Whites
have
from
up
college,
and left.
That was from Florissant. Okay, so Florissant has changed. Okay.
Yeah, whites have upped and left, where blacks make up 58% of Florissant, $109,000 income. Bloomfield, Connecticut, 58% black, $110,000 salary. Cambridge Heights, New York, 93% black, $119,000 salary. Number four, Olympia Field, Illinois, 70% black, $134,000 salary. Washington, D.C., 66% black, $158,000 salary. Baldwin Hills, California, 76 black. That's number two, $152,000 salary. Then you got, what is it, Bowie, Maryland?
Yep, suburb
Bowie,
of D.C.,
Maryland,
PG County. Yeah.
88% black, $174,000 salary.
Yeah, that's
where
I remember
blacks.
When Bowie was mostly white. But, yeah, but the blacks that live in Bowie are not poor people.
No, they're not. And guess what? Whites don't even want to live with them because you can't take a chance. You don't know who the heck they are. And you and see, they don't talk. They ain't going to say what they should say. That's another problem, too. Whites need to call it for what it is. But those blacks ain't causing no problem other than the education in school because they still got these ratchet public schools, education of their children, that is.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the problem? I don't know, but I tell you what, we shouldn't leave off the table. Some of these people are just cursed, L.A. What else could it be? Intergenerational problems that happened in the past, what you call karma, because Africa got rid of its riffraff. And in those societies today, they believe that the sins of the father follow the child. Maybe they curse.
Hmm.
What else
well,
is it? And also, you got these Democrats using them. And these damn anarchists. And, of course, you can't really say that because this influence, this attempt to influence has been going on for decades. You got recordings of it with people's names, places, and dates go back to the 19th, early 50s. And really, it goes back further than that. You go back toward the Marcus Garvey time. It was Negroes sicked the FBI on Marcus Garvey. It was Negroes that sicked the tried to get Hubert Harrison fired from his job because he was a street corner lecturer, stepladder lecturer, and they didn't like what he was doing. So I don't know. I think maybe they cursed. What else could it be? You put everything on the table except that.
Well,
it sounds
like
mean.
Well, you don't
sound
point
strange.
Out yet. Chicago has a black mayor. I'm sure the city council aldermen are well represented with black skin. A black lieutenant governor.
A congressperson. You got two congresspersons. Danny Davis.
Danny Davis.
And Bobby Rush.
Bobby Rush. And let's not forget the wealthy black entrepreneurs that live in the city.
Well, they ain't going to stay there long. Would you open up a damn store in the black community?
Well, I'm
you
talking about, you know, the long time. I don't know if he, I think he's still living. George Johnson, Ebony, what's the name of the
But he ain't out
Johnson
there. He
Products,
ain't out there exposed.
You know, Afro Sheen blowout kid people. They went
yeah,
Chicago.
He ain't out there exposed. You got Willie Wilson, too. Hey, they not out
okay.
there being exposed like that.
Right.
See, you got Barack Obama stay somewhere around the corner.
Right. Louis Farrakhan's
but,
in Chicago.
Absolutely.
Well,
they used to have
Mason
a print
Islam.
Shop up there. They got a restaurant
yeah,
there. You know, I don't give restaurants too much. Heck, you got restaurants every damn where. But the thing that I'm telling you, who in the heck's going to open up a store in one of these damn communities? And you got the logistical mindset of some of these black prosecutors that say, like Kim Fox, I'm sorry, like Kim Gardner down in St. Louis, say, if it looked like they need what they stole, leave them alone.
See, that's crazy.
They may mention one lady in your video talked about the Walgreens there in Chicago. Well, look, you don't have 17 Walgreens in San Francisco that closed up. Why? Because they got some damn dumbass law where you can come in the store and get a cart and fill the cart up $50 less than $1,000 and walk right out with it. Can't nobody stop you. Police ain't coming.
Well, that's going, well, like I say, you got these apps out here where people got the apps on their phone and they can have stuff delivered to their homes. And they might put, I guess, what do you call it, a distribution system? That's what some of these centers, rather, where they're going to be out of reach.
And where is
the
FBI in that? FBI can be messing with Trump. But you got people that's going in these stores. You can be messing with people that participate in a protest January the 6th. But you got these fools going in and out of these stores, burning, looting, stealing, killing. You got them on camera. Why come you don't go after them? They traveled around the country. Why come you don't go after them? That's the question that needs to be asked.
Any possible solutions? Other than, well, moving out of the
You know,
city
I'm going to tell you
solution.
Something. Last night, yesterday, I was on some websites looking for some weapons for my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, damn near every website I went to, I got this message under the models that I would like to look at. I was looking at a PPK. MKS-25, and others. It said unavailable, out of stock. Practically everyone unavailable, out of stock. That there should tell you something. You're going to get people hemmed up with their backs up against the wall, then they're going to lash out, which they should have done a long time ago. You had 3,000 black millionaires move off of South Shore Drive there in Chicago and went further out. St. Louis, blacks in Ferguson went further out. It can't be white police because they went to an area where the majority of not only the people is white, but the police departments are white.
All right.
So who are they running from? I ask you that question. From what I told you and all evidence at hand, who are they running from? They're running from other blacks. That's who they're running from. And I feel,
yeah, they're,
you know,
they're people that they don't want to live with other ones.
No, you can't blame them. Skin ain't kin.
That's true. But unfortunately, you do have quite a few black folk. You know, what's interesting, you know, I watch these videos there where some black folks, black Americans have moved over to Africa. And they're all hyped of the idea of going to the motherland. But when they get there, they realize the mindset is different. And they don't operate in black and white. They're tribal. I mean, it's
they don't
you know.
Look at African American as being no brother and sister.
Exactly. They don't look at them as being African.
Other than tourist dollars.
Right.
On the way back to, on the way from the airport, oh, man, how you doing, cousin, and all that stuff. After you've been there a week or two and spent up your money, on the way back to the airport, they want to hurry up and get your butt up out of there. Get on that plane, get back where you came from.
And a lot of them do go back.
And see, you don't understand. You see, you don't realize that until you get around these people.
Mm-hmm.
When you sleep in their bed, in their house, listen to them talk, eat with them, and listen to the discussions. You don't think of no black Americans as no brothers and sisters. Yeah, you get killed just as quick as anybody else, if not faster.
Mm-hmm.
And rightfully so.
Well, completely different culture, different countries, different cultures, different tribes, different languages. And like I say, a lot of blacks, they're looking at that skin folk should be kinfolk, but it doesn't work that way.
Absolutely. Human, but they steal
even
your
in this
money
country,
if
it doesn't work that
if
way.
If you let them get what. They steal your money if you let them get away with it, the money you got in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
You would get statements monthly. All of a sudden, they stop, L.A. They stop coming. You say, where's my statement? And you try to inquire on that. They come up with all kind of reasons and all kind of flip-flops that you got to go through in order to get the statements flowing again. Oh, it's what they're doing is setting things up so they can steal your money.
Well, I'm going to see tomorrow. What's tomorrow? What's tomorrow? Friday? They Thursday already?
The week go by fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, shut up. I'm going to see if I can line up some Chicago.
I sent you an email message on some more stuff, like this judge in Ohio is requiring this black male to get a COVID shot as a condition of his probation.
Hmm.
Now,
I'll look that over.
What about the Tuskegee? Okay, what about the Tuskegee experiment?
The Tuskegee, that's a good question.
Wait a minute. Where is the NAACP? Where is your usual civil rights attorneys? Requiring a black male to get a COVID shot as a condition of probation. All these Negroes complaining about this?
Yeah, Black Lives Matter. Where
you don't
are they?
Hear them. Where are they? Warren, you may have an opportunity to represent this young man. Of course, apparently he don't know. He's smiling over it. But there are. Where is Joe Madison and all them? That if it was white folks, it would be all holy murder. Where is Benjamin Crump?
Benjamin Crump. Like Al Sharpton, you just see vultures. You see vultures come on the scene after something's dead. We won't see Al Sharpton probably won't surface. He'll resurface on
the
national scene after somebody else dies. That's what
you see the young black woman, Samara Stock Mensa, that won the gold for American Olympic wrestling.
Which sport? Track?
Wrestling.
Gymnastics.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know. I didn't catch that one.
She's black. Mensa. Well, Mensa, the name tells you land, history, and culture. Her father's Ghanaian. Mensa.
Mm-hmm. And wrestling,
she's married to a white man. Wait a minute, she's married to a white man who's a former Olympic wrestler. But she beat a Nigerian female. And she's donning herself in the American flag. And she's making remarks on how wonderful it feels to represent the United States of America. And then you got those other black females and males, too, that won gold for representing the American United States, and they donning themselves in the American flag. Negroes hate that, L.A. Don't say
yeah,
that.
Gwen Berry.
Gwen Berry was
trial.
The hammer throw.
Right. And she
that
froze,
was pissed off because
right.
She said she was ambushed when she had
yeah.
to stand up on the podium and listen to the American anthem.
Right. And it's interesting that she didn't medal at
dummy.
All. Yeah,
wait
she
a
didn't
minute.
Medal at all in the Olympics.
She's a dummy. She came in third in the trials. Well,
mm-hmm.
damn, it's the first place winner that they played a national anthem for. You had two white women ahead of you. Second and third, they played the national anthem for them. And you going to say that you was ambushed, had to listen to, because of your Black Lives Matter attitude and hate American attitude, you didn't want to be up there for the national anthem. But wait
you know,
a minute.
If you have a problem with the United States, particularly with the Olympics, okay.
Hang on.
Don't,
wait a minute. I know Warren know this. Wait a minute. Wait a minute, L.A. Somebody went back into the archives and pulled out a picture of her being an awardee of an event, and guess what she wrapped herself up in? The American flag.
Mm-hmm.
These old hypocritical fakes. You got some hypocritical fakes out there. She wasn't too damn a black to wrap, not to wrap herself up in the American flag years ago.
Right.
That's what I'm talking
because
about.
The Olympics, they...
All
they,
this
they,
stuff. All this stuff that blacks are doing is racist for no other pure identity, definition of the act. It's the act. You got nothing to do with no skin color. You got Negroes out here that's as racist as anybody else.
You know what? That's the topic for tomorrow's podcast. Kim, because you got some black folks that say a black person can't be racist. I disagree. But
because of what? They ain't got no power.
Well, once again, Lieutenant Governor. Anyway, I'm going to bring them on here tomorrow. Let people defend that theory, so to speak.
And here's the thing. You got more and more black, quote-unquote, and the only way you can describe it is that you got to be able to distinguish between the two. So, you know, you distinguish one as being conservative. I mean, you can say whatever else, but the simple terminology for what it is that you are recognizing and how they carry out their politics and their social lifestyle is conservative.
Right.
More and more of them are coming out. They're sick and tired of all this bull crap. Don't be trying to include me amongst your we when you haven't asked me, in other words, given the opportunity, I wouldn't choose to be amongst your we. And then at some point in time, you will realize that your we ain't all about that anyway. It's about like the Maytag man.
True. Well, on that note,
all right.
I'm going to let you hit. That's the last word of the day. We'll be back here tomorrow. Unless something comes up trending, we're going to talk about can black folks be racist?